up in the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue, kind of two back-to-back hearings this afternoon. Welcome back, Senator George.
Good to be here.
It's good to see you. We'll try to... Senator George has minor ear issues, so we'll try not to move too quickly. That would throw off...
I'm the one that has to move slowly.
Slow.
Everybody else can move quickly. My eyes will be behind you.
And thanks, folks, for coming this evening. We have a hearing at 6, and then we have another hearing at 6:30, and we had to do that for our 48-hour requirement. So that is why we are meeting a little late this evening. I am going to open up a hearing on first. We have two property tax-related bills that the assessors in particular might be interested in. And I'll open first 653. Open a public hearing on 653 and Senator Walker's in another committee. I'll hand it over to our staff and then have Senator Walker come up with her.
Well, very briefly, this bill, Senate Bill 653, will permit tax-exempt entities to claim an exemption for property held under sublease from a taxable owner. And under current law, I believe that exemption exists if it is a lease or a lease purchase agreement, but not for a sublease.
Great.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. And seated to my right is Sandy Hallinan from Eugene from NEDCO and Ted Everhart from the community from Portland. And they'll introduce themselves and talk mostly about the bill. This is probably the most simple bill I've ever introduced in my 9 years in the legislature. It adds two words. It adds sublease or sublessee, and that's about all it says throughout the bill. It's a very simple fix to a problem that has created, it's created a problem for a number of nonprofit agencies because under the statutes, they cannot sublease to another entity and retain their tax-exempt status. So this is a problem that has beset other nonprofit organizations around the state. This happened to beset an organization in my community, and so I stepped in to try to solve the problem. I'll let these folks talk about it, and I'll scoot back down the hallway to this massive hearing we have in Hearing Room E.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Sandy Hallinan with Neighborhood Economic Development Corporation, NEDCO, in Eugene. We are a nonprofit organization founded in 1979, the state's first community development corporation, and what we do is to help neighborhoods and families build assets primarily through homeownership, neighborhood revitalization, and business development. And we do a lot of work with first-time home buyers, and we've actually built 130 homes in the last 15 years for low-income first-time home buyers. What I want to do is explain the situation we found ourselves in last summer. We had so much increase in our activity that we needed to move to a new location. And so we moved to a new location and signed a lease with the business to be in that location. At the same time, that business was getting a Small Business Administration loan. And so we actually signed the lease with the LLC that they were using to purchase the business. And the LLC and the business are identical, the identical people. So that the SBA then said that rather than the having a lease with us, the SBA required the LLC to lease back 100% of the property to the business and then sublease it to us. So we had to turn our lease into a sublease. It was a Small Business Administration requirement, and that sublease meant that we couldn't get tax exemption. That's the gist of the problem. We did not realize that was going to happen until we applied for our tax exemption because we have had exemptions in the past, and the sublease, we learned that it didn't do that. So That's $4,000. It's a little more than $4,000. That seems like a small amount of money in the kind of budgets that you work with, but it's very significant for us. And it means that we can't work with as many families to help them for home ownership. And I think this is particularly distressing because we know that the work that we do actually decreases the default rate by homeowners very significantly. So in trying to decide whether we wanted to do an appeal, we talked to an attorney and spent some money. We decided that we really didn't have much of a chance to win, and we decided we just couldn't spend the money. But it was also just suggested that so many people have, so many other nonprofits have had the same problem, that we go in ahead and try to see if we could get the law changed. And that's why I'm here.
Great.
Thank you.
Great. Democracy in action.
Chairman Deckard, members of the committee, my name is Tad Everhart. I'm a lawyer with the Community Development Law Center in Portland, Oregon. We're a project of Legal Aid Services of Oregon, and our address is 921 Southwest Washington, Suite 454 in Portland. We do legal aid work at either no cost or a low cost to charitable organizations throughout Oregon, primarily in the area of affordable housing, but also in community development projects. In working with NEDCO, we discovered the problem with this statute and had a number of discussions. Oregon law generally provides that a charitable organization that owns property and uses it for its charitable purpose enjoys exemption from property tax on that land. And that exemption is not just for property that the organization owns, but it's for property that the organization leases. What's critical is that the organization uses the property for the charitable purpose. What we want to do is extend that to property that an organization might find is best by a sublease. In other words, they would lease from the sublessee, or the lessee, excuse me. They would be a sublessee. This situation arises that in 1977, two laws were enacted, this statute, 307.112, and ORS 307.166. Unfortunately, one was written by a committee on the House side, the other was written by a committee on the Senate side, and the language is close but different. And the courts have struggled with trying to decide what the legislature's intent was, because in the other statute, 307.166, it covers both leasing and subleasing. But in this statute, it only refers to leasing and a lease purchase. So essentially what we're asking you to do is to make those two statutes consistent, and we believe it was your intent that as long as the purpose was carried out with the property, the charitable purpose, that you intended that that property be exempt from property taxes. If you have questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Great. Thank you. Questions for this panel? Did you listen to the tapes, or you mentioned that you believed it was the intent a couple sessions back that we would include, and did you just listen to the tapes or get the transcripts, and was there a discussion around that point? Or?
There's a case where the Supreme Court of Oregon discussed what was the legislature intending, because the House Revenue Committee produced one bill and the Senate Revenue Committee produced the other bill, and apparently the tax court said it said they weren't talking to each other. And so we have these two statutes pretty close together in the same section of ORS that really are just slightly different, and no one knows what the legislature intended, whether it was a principled difference or just different writing.
We've got Paul Warner now, and he'll ensure that that doesn't occur, not on his watch, as he watches both committees.
Great.
Thank you. Ms. Tamara Miller, Terry McDonald, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Tamara Miller, and I am employed by Peace Health, a Washington nonprofit organization that has three hospitals in the state of Oregon, in Eugene, Cottage Grove, and Florence. And the mailing address for Peace Health is 1255 Hilliard Street in Eugene, Oregon, 97477. Peace Health has provided health care services in the state of Oregon and Washington, in the states of Oregon and Washington, since 1890. Peace Health is a nonprofit that is qualified as an exempt entity under ORS 307-130. Peace Health has applied for exemption on properties that it uses or occupies under the state statutes, and including 307-112. This past year, in 2006, Peace Health found itself in a situation where it had subleased property, and the uses for that property were our Oregon Medical Labs, which is our main medical laboratory, and that the building that the land sits on that we were denied exemption on also houses our billing office, our patient billing office, and other critical support services such as our supply warehouse for our organization. The approximation of the amount of money that we paid this year in taxes that we would have been otherwise eligible to exempt under ORS 112, but for the fact that it was under sublease, was approximately $190,000. That is money that could have otherwise been provided to the healthcare in the form of healthcare to our community. I've listed on my written testimony several programs that money could have been used to support. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate you coming to Salem.
Good evening, Senator Deckert and members of the committee. I'm Terry McDonald. I'm the executive director of St. Vincent de Paul Society of Lane County. And St. Vincent de Paul is a charitable nonprofit organization that deals with housing emergency services and a variety of economic development activities in the Lane County area. And one of the things that we like to work on is areas of low income and areas where there's blighted or difficult business transactions to try and get those business areas built back up by using a variety of the business tools that we have available to us, including businesses of our own. One of the things that we've learned over time, of course, is that one of the places that is most vulnerable are places that have had businesses that have failed. And that they hold a lease on that property, and that property is sitting there holding and paying on it, but is not producing the kind of thing that you'd like to have in a neighborhood, which would be an active and thriving business. We also recognize that since we're going to be developing a business there ourselves, that a lessee position for us simply just puts another one of the more difficult hurdles in front of us, because typically we would be putting in a business that would be exempt from our taxes, but with a sublet situation, it really precludes that. So it actually precludes us and actually works against our activities to try and actually make a better community for their area. And as doing so, it diminishes our ability to be able to carry forward our mission of community development in our local areas. And especially in areas where there's high vacancies or areas that are blighted, these are places you would really like to have more business development, more activity in them. But when they have a lease on them and they can't sublet out to us without going on the rolls, just precludes us from working on those areas. We generally go to different places to try and make sure that we get maximum benefit for the higher difficulty businesses and the higher risks that we take in those areas. So I would urge you to go ahead and get this fixed up for us.
Well, thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Appreciate your time. Department of Revenue, anything you feel needs to be added? John?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. Just one comment, and that is, of course, we're neither in support of John Phillips, Department of Revenue. I'm sorry. Thank you. You also have Senate Bill 816, which was sponsored by the committee, and Senate Bill 816 does almost the same thing. It amends the same statute by just adding a little paragraph at the end about subleasing. The two bills are different in only one way that I can tell, and that bill would require an exempt lessee to lease to a sublessor who is exempt, whereas this bill would allow any taxable or non-taxable entity to sublease. So this is a little more allowable in terms of, you know, to whom it could be sublet and then considered exempt.
So what are the scenarios? I think I know them, but the scenarios is if we pass 816, the examples that we were given this evening, they would only be able to then sublease to another exempt organization.
Mr. Chair, both start out with the same premise that it's a taxable ownership. And then one of them assumes that it goes to an exempt lease, and then the exempt lease subleases to an exempt lease. The other one starts out taxable, then goes to non-taxable, and then stays non-taxable. So, and I think the gentleman mentioned a really critical point. I didn't catch his name, but that it is primarily the use of the property in the end final analysis that's the principle in property tax law. So it does seem like a kind of a strange situation we find ourselves in currently.
Yeah. And did the two bill... Other questions for John? Yes, Senator George.
Do you think this is the best way to define it, finally?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I would say that if you want to focus on who's using the property and what they're using it for without getting into a future bill that would have somebody here saying the same thing, the 653 appears to nail it down a little tighter. Does that answer your question, Senator George?
Good, thanks. Okay.
And prior to the two, I guess, conflicting bills that passed, how are situations like this handled in terms of taxable entity, subleasee that's exempt? I guess the question is, did the two bills that passed that seem to contradict themselves create the situation that we find ourselves in today, or has this always been an issue for organizations like the one that testified?
Mr. Chair, I think the two bills that were referred to did deal with the two different statutes, one starting with the taxable ownership and then moving through a series of leases and subleases. The other statute, 307-166, starts with an exempt ownership and then moves through maybe taxable and then exempt and on down the line. So it's actually starting from two different ownership situations, and that's the primary difference. And I don't think that they were necessarily conflicting. It's just that they weren't. The concept was not carried through in tandem. So great. This would bring them closer together.
Yeah. Senator Monroe.
Yeah, I, for the last decade, have belonged to a charitable nonprofit, Fish Emergency Services, on the east side of Portland. And we serve over 10,000 of the neediest people with, you know, food, sometimes housing help, and used clothing. And so anything we can do to facilitate these kinds of organizations, I will support. It's absolutely critical they provide help to people that otherwise would be out on the street or starving or both.
Right. Commendable that we have two senators here who are both battling, as you can hear. Thank you very much, John. Anyone else on 653? Close public hearing. Open public hearing on Senate Bill 697. Mary.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 697 will require that a county assessor reduce the minimum assessed value of property when buildings are demolished or removed. And under current law, I believe that is possible when the property has been destroyed or damaged by fire or by an act of God, but not in the situation where it's been demolished.
Great. This is Senator Morris's bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, for the record, Senator Frank Morris representing Lynn and Benton counties. I think in terms of referencing this bill, just a little bit of the background, I was in Doug Philpott's office in the interim, and Doug is with me at the witness table as he's the Benton County assessor. And we were talking about some constituent issues, and this issue arose, and so that's the genesis of bringing that forward. I think the best way to address this is through a copy that I have provided you from the Oregon Tax Court Magistrate Division. And it's a decision that was rendered in October of 2006. And as the major summary was described, the case revolves around the legal question of whether the demolition of a structure at the owner's request requires a reduction in the assessed value of the property. And what this fellow found in Clatsop County was he had removed a cabin, and in fact his taxes went up rather than went down. So he filed this case in the magistrate court of the tax court, and I would refer to you page 3 the bottom paragraph, oddly, and quoting from the findings, oddly, maximum assessed value can be increased where new property is added to existing property, but there is no corresponding provision allowing for a decrease in maximum assessed value where an existing structure is voluntarily removed by the owner. And then over the last paragraph on page 4, I think really drives to the heart of this issue and why it's before us today. Plaintiff finds that the disparity...
Where are you? You're on page 4.
Page 4, the bottom paragraph, where it's kind of the conclusion of the court that says the plaintiff finds the disparity in the law between a building destroyed by fire and one voluntarily raised by the owner to be decidedly unfair and illogical. The court agrees that there is room for improvement in the governing law. However, any changes would have to come from the legislature and not the court. So that, very simply, is the issue. And I would invite Mr. Philpott to provide additional information that might be relevant, comments that you have. Property tax law is certainly not is not my expertise, and that's why I like the plain spoken language of this magistrate's decision.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Good evening.
Good evening. Senator Deckard, Chair, and committee members. My name is Doug Hillpott. I'm Benton County Assessor, although I'm here representing the Association of County Assessors. And as usual, fairness is a big issue with us. And there are things that we run across in current tax law that just seem so unfair that we really appreciate when a senator or representative will come forward and address some of this. And certainly I think just reading through here, it defies reason why if somebody's house burns down, we can adjust the maximum assessed value. When they build a new house, of course, new maximum assessed value would go on for the new one. If it is torn down for some reason or something like that, we are prohibited from reducing the maximum assessed value. And if they build something new, it goes right on top of it. Now, there is a small window called netting. So if they tore something down in 1 year and rebuilt something new in the same year, then there is some adjustment that's allowed. But too often, that does not happen. So it's just a fairness issue, and it's something, I guess, that's always bothered me since I've become assessor, and I'm very appreciative that it's being addressed now.
Great. Thank you for bringing this to our attention. I certainly didn't know it was a facet of our property tax law. Senator Monroe.
Thank you. Would this bill require you to reduce the value if a dilapidated cabin or other structure is removed from a piece of land? Would it absolutely require you to lower the value?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, in Section 1 it says shall, but in Section 3, which was the statute that originally was for the square footage air correction, it does say may. In either case, if you are dealing with current tax year and the formula that's an administrative rule, let's just take square footage air for instance, you look at the total real market value and whatever percentage that is, say, of that old dilapidated building, and you now apply that percentage. So say we had a $200,000 property and maybe it was a $2,000 building, well, that's only 1%, so you're not adjusting very much, if anything at all.
Well, Mr. Chair, the reason I ask the question is I've been in the apartment business for a long time. One time I had an apartment house, and I bought the adjacent land to add additional apartments, and on the adjacent land was a dilapidated excuse for a house that actually was a liability to the value of that land. The land was worth more with the structure removed. Of course, I had to pay to have it removed before I could build on it. And that's the reason I asked the question, because a structure on a piece of land does not necessarily add to the overall value of that land. Sometimes it diminishes it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, that is correct. And certainly there are instances where calling something an improvement is kind of a misnomer, but we do have situations where, yes, it's if someone bought it and had the teardown costs, that, certainly that's a negative against the rest of it. But in property taxation, we're not allowed to show a negative on the roll. There's always a token value, so there's not much of a case, you know, for if it's something that we virtually have no value on or very token value, that this would come under that. And that's why having the may adjust is real important, because we don't want to spend what limited resources we have unless it's something really worthwhile. What I'm referring to is maybe some of the, we recently had an older hotel, motel that was torn down, and we still had a little over $1 million on the roll because it was quite large. But the new owner tore it down, had the expense of that, and has no way of getting that MAV adjusted, and when they build the new structure, it's going to go right on top of the other maximum assessed value.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, I certainly understand that and support this bill, but I want to make sure that it doesn't require assessors automatically to reduce value, because in some cases, value is not reduced. It may even be enhanced by the removal of a building.
Thank you. Everyone's minds were in the room were just filled with examples of that, where it would enhance the property's value to remove other questions or comments for this panel. How common we see here in this case that was litigated, and I'm going to mispronounce his name, but Mr. Ballou took it and litigated it. How common is it for folks in Benton County, for example, to have these cases and your hands are tied in terms of reducing their property tax?
Mr. Chair, thank goodness we haven't had very many. We are a small county, but throughout the state, I know it's fairly common in some of the larger counties, particularly the north, with Washington, Clackamas, Multnomah. And here again, our hands are tied to be able to do anything.
Great. Appreciate bringing this to us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Department of Revenue, anything that ought to be said about this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Phillips for the record of the Department of Revenue. I wasn't planning to say anything, but I think Senator Monroe brings out a good point. My reading of the bill is that in Section 1, Subsection 8, which is on page 2, line, starting in lines 28, I think the assessor is required. I think the shall there is incumbent upon the assessor to reduce the value, but only to the degree that it reflects a reduction in market value. So if they remove the home that you suggested was actually a detriment to the property, you know, in the assessor's opinion, that did not carry real market value of significance, or was a drag or a down pull on that, it probably would be no change.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Monroe.
Wouldn't that make it cleaner if that shall was changed to may?
It would make it, Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, it would make it cleaner if you wanted the assessor to have the option.
I'm discussing.
Yes.
And
yeah, absolutely, I do.
But that's a policy decision.
Okay. Yeah. Mr. Chair, I'd like to have that amendment prepared.
Mary's got it. Senator Morris, are you comfortable? I'll let you guys talk offline, but your assessors were nodding that providing them discretion so that they don't have to go out and check everyone, but that they can use their own discretion. That's not an emphatic nod, but we'll take it.
Mr. Chair, I think what Section 3 does that Assessor Doug Hillpot referenced was the section that does talk about if someone comes to the assessor and says, I would like, and here's my application, a reduction in my maximum assessed value. That's the may part. And that usually refers to, is designed to deal with square footage errors. That way the assessor is, it's not incumbent upon the assessor to go out and scope out and check every house to make sure the square footage is correct in every case. But that does give the option. I don't know of any assessor that hasn't done that. But this would require, this section would require it, which we are, again, like I said, we're neutral on one way or the other. It's just simply a policy choice.
Yeah, no, glad you're following these property tax issues very closely. It's the most interesting part of our tax law is property tax.
Sure, I live for it.
You're the only one. Thank you, Senator Morris. Any other questions on 697? close the public hearing on Senate Bill 697. Paul, are you going to come up here? Not, I don't think you've ever been down at the witness table. We could grill Paul.
Where's Jim?
So we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2707C. Paul Warner, we know these bills, but...
You know the bills intimately, but I have a summary sheet for you that has the Rainy Day Fund agreement on it. It actually has a description of both 2707 and 2031 as they came to you from the House. And I can go through that sheet for you very quickly, and then a revenue impact on the other side of that to show you what the net impact is on the general fund and the newly created rainy day fund. What 2707 does is, as the Constitution prescribes, it increases the estimate upon which the corporate kicker calculation is based. Currently, the close of session estimates right about $500 million. What 2707 does is increase that to $975 million. So it increases that estimate by $475 million. The current estimate for the corporate income taxes that you received about a week and a half ago is $815 million. So what this does is... by increasing that estimate, it directs the difference between what actually comes in and the close of session estimate into the rainy day fund, the newly created rainy day fund, and pulls out $24.8 million for the general fund to cover the credit costs associated with 2031. So keep in mind that the way the bill is written, it's the actual minus the close of session that goes in the rainy day fund after that transfer to the general fund. So it can be all the way up to $450 million potentially going to the general fund if the actual revenues would go up high enough. But right now our March estimate is this would be $290.3 million that would go into the newly created reserve fund. Also, the bill creates up to 1% of general fund ending balance starting in the 09-11 biennium. We estimated that at $138.4 million in 09-11. And it tasks Department of Administrative Services with calculating imputed interest on the account in the general fund. And you recall we talked about this in Senate Bill 48 that came through the committee. And this actually puts in the language, as you'll notice, in Section 1, Sub 3, requires that each month the Department of Administrative Services to calculate the amount of general fund interest that is attributable to the rainy day fund, but keeping in mind that it is within the general fund, so those dollars can be used for cash flow management. So if you look at the other side of the piece of paper there, it has the revenue impact numbers, rainy day fund agreement, revenue impact estimates, and you can see that the net of 2707 on the general fund and 0709 is plus 24.8, and that ends up being distributed out in this one-time corporation credit that's in 2031 for a net of zero. And then we estimate that $138.4 million based on the governor's budget would be the 1% ending balance calculation in the 09-11 biennium. On the rainy day fund in 07-09 with the $26 million in estimated interest earnings from this account within the general fund, we estimate a fund balance of $316.4 million on July 1 of 09, and then a fund balance on July 1 of 2011 of $495.8 million, given the ending balance transfer and the additional imputed interest. The rainy day fund characteristics I've listed there, those characteristics are the same as the Education Stability Fund. They each of those requires a three-fifth. It's an or, but it requires a three-fifths of both chambers. There's no reference to an emergency declaration by the governor as there currently is in the Constitution. So that's a difference in this bill and the current Education Stability Fund. The fund is capped at 7.5% of general fund revenue in the prior biennium. And the way it's written, there's a two-step calculation. When DAS is transferring money into that rainy day fund, it would look to see before the transfer if it's below the 7.5%. If it is, it transfers the entire amount in. Mm-hmm. So you can have over 7.5% from one transfer from interest, for example, or an ending balance transfer. But if you look the next month when you make the transfer, you'll see that you're over 7.5%. So the entire amount goes back into the goes back into the general fund in the way it was amended in the, on the House side. The other issue is that no more than two-thirds of the fund balance can be allocated in any one biennium. And that was something that you discussed and included in Senate Bill 48. But we also added a little bit of language to this so that, and you can see it on the top of page 2, the issue came up as we were thinking through this, how it might work, the issue of two-thirds of what. So you kind of needed a point in time in which you do the two-thirds calculation. So what the bill says, it would be two-thirds of the balance in the fund at the beginning of the biennium. We also anticipated a time when you may be in session. So you're in session now, and you're looking forward to 07-09. You're saying, gee, we're going to need some revenue from the fund to balance. Then it allows you to use the most recent estimate of the ending balance for that current biennium rather than the actual. So those are just kind of practical nuts and bolts in terms of implementing the two-thirds policy decision that was also contained in Senate Bill 48. So those are the rainy day fund characteristics. The other thing I'll point out that the House put in is Section 7 of the bill. You'll notice that, and I'm sure you're aware of this, does not become operated unless the Bean Gross version of 2031 is passed by both houses and signed by the governor on or before this Friday. The bill takes the earlier versions we looked at had an emergency clause. This one just states that it takes effect on May 1, 2007. The Constitution requires you to change the estimate prior to the end of the year. So as long as you do it before July 1, it'll be consistent. So that, Mr. Chair, is 2707.
Great. Thank you, Paul. I know you've spent a few hours on this bill. I was looking through the meetings, number of meetings held, and quickly got up to 8 or 9, both between the House and the Senate on this issue. Questions for Paul Rollinger? I don't have anyone set up to testify. One question I had just on the measure history, it says 54 votes in the House. My understanding is it passed 48-7 or 48-9 in the House.
Mr. Chair, that was my recollection as well.
I watched it.
Yes.
That's minor if our measure history.
Turn to the next page. It's a two-page measure history.
Oh, there it is. 48-9. Correct. Other questions for Paul Warner? Thank you. Anyone wish to testify on this measure? Mazin, you want to get in on this? You're the only one in here that has not testified on the... inside, there won't be a next time.
I like that. Yes.
I hope. close the public hearing on House Bill 2707. Open a work session on House Bill 2707.
Good chair.
Yes, Senator Starr.
I've got a couple of amendments I'd like to propose to House Bill 2707, and each of you should have received a copy of those. The stack here actually just passed out in the last couple of minutes. If I might, Mr. Chair.
Please offer amendments.
Great, thank you. It's a C-11 amendments, and I think there's a C-12 amendment. I'll start with the C-11s. Mr. Chair, I'd move the C-11 amendments to House Bill 2707.
Senator Saar has moved the adoption of the C-11 amendments to House Bill 2707. Just hand it back to Senator Saar.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. This is a very simple amendment. Mr. Chair, what this does is it changes the 7.5% cap to 10%. As we've had discussions in this committee, I think that the consensus here was a 10% cap on a reserve fund made a lot of sense. So the bills that we moved out of this committee, had the 10% as a cap. Mr. Chair, this especially makes sense when you talk about a two-thirds limitation on withdrawal in any one biennium. Not having been invited or participated in any negotiations on this with the House, I thought it was important that this committee and the Senate at least have an opportunity to weigh in on this very important point of creating a reserve fund with a cap that really would accommodate the legislative process, the legislature, when we are faced with that next recession. I think this is essentially critically important piece of policy that this committee really ought to adopt as it relates to House Bill 2707.
Senator Starr has moved the C-11s. The two principal reasons why we can't, and I certainly understand the rationale, we included it in Senate Bill 48, is if we adopt any amendments to this bill, we will miss that March 16th critical deadline. Senator Monroe.
Yeah, I philosophically absolutely support going to a higher cap, 10 or even 15, but because there was such a delicate balance in the House, and they did get it passed, and any amendments that we do would cause it to be sent back to the House, I will not be supporting any amendments.
Other thoughts on the C-11s?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Burdick.
I concur with you and Senator Monroe, and I would only point out that this is a statutory change, and I would like to let Senator Starr know that I will help him at the next time we convene, which probably will be next year, if he still wants to pursue this, because I think it would be a good policy move.
Got your three votes, just not on March 12th.
Mr. Chair, maybe I should have a conceptual amendment to delete the section, what is that, 7 in this bill? It makes no sense to me that we have an artificial deadline on a bill out there that really precludes the legislature, the Senate in particular, from moving good public policy forward.
Mr. Chair, if I can add to that, I think it's very, very unlikely we're going to reach the Senate, the 7.5% threshold before we meet next time. So I don't think there's anything lost here.
That's actually, it'll be quite a while before we hit both the 5 and 12.5. Senator Starr's moved the C-11 amendments. Barbara, can you call the roll?
No.
Aye.
No.
Votes aye.
Chair Deckard.
Votes no. And the motion fails.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Starr.
I appreciate the committee's indulgences here. I recognize the foregone conclusion, but I thought it was important that these issues be raised. I move the C-12 amendments to House Bill 2707.
Senator Starr has moved the adoption of the C-12 amendments to House Bill 2707. Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, real simply, what this amendment would do, it would delete the 1% ending fund allocation to the reserve fund, and it would, in its place, substitute a 2% front-end appropriations to the reserve fund. If we've had a discussion in this committee and really throughout this legislative session, it's been real clear from my perspective that it's important that the legislature budget for a reserve fund. Force some fiscal discipline into this process, fiscal restraint. Force us to take money that we can spend today and put it away for that rainy day. This is especially important when we look at the huge amount of increase in revenues available for this legislature to appropriate this session. If we can't take money off the table in a budget cycle where we have vast amounts of new tax dollars flooding this building, I don't know whenever we can. I think this is really important that if we're going to create a savings plan or a savings bill, a rainy day bill, that we actually take money that we can spend today off the table and budget it and put it into the reserve fund. 2% is not my favorite number. I would have preferred 3%, Mr. Chair, but I recognize that that created a hurdle, of, at least for some members, that was insurmountable. And so to compromise, I dropped it to a 2% appropriation. Mr. Chair, I think that this is, again, good public policy. It would set about this legislature on record that we're going to, in good times when we have a lot of additional revenue or not, that we're going to save money in a reserve fund for that next recession. So, Mr. Chair, I submit the dash C-12 for the committee's consideration. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Starr's move the dash C-12s. Thoughts or comments on the C-12s? Again, this is a carefully crafted compromise between the House and the Senate, and any amendments. We did do 1%, which I think along with the 15% of lottery proceeds really meets that skin in the game test of the state putting current revenues that it could spend, 15% of lottery revenues plus 1% of general fund, into reserves. To me, is actually relatively historic in terms of our ability to take money out of our revenue streams, and I think it's a big step for this legislature that we have not been willing to take in the past, of taking money out of current revenue streams and putting them into reserves, coupled with, in this bill, the one-time corporate kicker augmentation. Other thoughts on the C-12s? Barbara?
Senator
Burdick?
No.
Senator
George?
Aye.
Senator
Monroe?
No.
Senator Starr?
Votes yes.
Senator Chair
Decker?
Votes no. The motion fails.
I don't have any more amendments.
Are there other amendments that I could search my pile here?
I could do some conceptual amendments, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. How long do you want to stay around?
Get your cell phones. Senator Monroe.
Are you ready for a motion?
I think we've exhausted our amendments.
Yeah, I would move House Bill 2707C to the floor of the Senate with a D-pass recommendation.
Senator Rob Monroe has moved House Bill 2707C to the floor with a D-pass recommendation. Discussion on that motion. Senator Shaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am going to oppose that motion. I think it should be abundantly clear to everybody on this dais, to the 30 members of the Oregon Senate, to those in the audience, and those that are listening anywhere in the world via the World Wide Web and broadband internet, that what this bill does is it suspends Oregon's Constitution. And I don't think that we should do that lightly. And I think as most of us were here when the vote was taken in this process, in this building, to put the kicker into the Constitution, I'm not sure this was the exact emergency that those of us that voted in support of that were thinking of. I don't believe an emergency exists here. We are, again, as I mentioned, flooded with increased tax dollars. Oregonians have been extremely generous with their tax dollars, and this really, as far as I'm concerned, doesn't meet my ideas about what we should do to create a reserve fund. There's no pain here. There's no forced fiscal restraint. I understand that the 1% at the end of the ending fund balance, does take some money off the table, perhaps, but there's no guarantees there. If there happens to be an ending fund balance, there that doesn't mean that there will be one. I would suggest that based on the editorial in the paper today as it relates to economist Romero, again, doesn't quite line up with what was talked about on the Senate floor a few short days ago about all economists or economists on both sides of the aisle think that this is a grand idea. I would just suggest that the business community isn't unanimous. I've heard from a number of businesses in my district that that don't support their corporate kicker being sent to the reserve fund. So the business community is not unanimous in their support of this. Let me just say that 2707 is better than SGR 3, at least on one front, in that it does carve out an exception for some small businesses. Let me also say that because this is not a constitutional amendment, the triggers in this bill have virtually no effect. It's a statutory measure. With a vote of 16 in the Senate and 31 in the House, all that language as it relates to the triggers are irrelevant. Those triggers, I think, are important, and they have worked extremely well as it relates to the Education Stability Fund, which is in the Constitution. So, Mr. Chair, for those reasons, and probably more that I could go on about, but for those at least, I'm not going to be supporting House Bill 2707.
Other thoughts or concerns, or Barbara, we're going to keep you busy this evening.
Senator Blake.
Aye. Senator Joyce.
No.
Senator Monroe.
Aye.
No.
Chair Decker. Aye. The motion passes. Open a public.
You carry it.
I'll carry the bill. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2031.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2031 has gone through a number of different versions, but the B version you see before you essentially has one tax credit in it, which is a one-year tax credit of 67% of what tax liability would be, a credit against that liability for C corporations that have tax year sales of $5 million or more. And I put in a table for you that shows the corporations that we estimate. This is on 2004 C Corps for Oregon sales. But just to give you a sense of how many filers and what the taxable income is for those, and based on sale up to $5 million. So you can see it's a majority of corporation actually in terms of numbers. The revenue impact is the same as the diversion we had in House Bill 2707, $24.8 million. That's based on the estimated liability of what those corporations would owe, and so taking 67% of that. The 67% credit is based on the latest revenue forecast, which projects a kicker estimate of 67% for the credit. So rather than waiting till the end of the biennium to do the actual kicker calculation as you do under current law, this bill would just set that 67% so that would be known for certain by corporations. The only other element in the bill is that similar to House Bill 2707, this bill has a section 3, that states that the operative sections 1 and 2, does not become operative unless the See and Gross Bill 2707 is passed by both houses and signed by the governor by this Friday, March 16th.
The day before St. Patrick's Day.
By which I'll be feeling much better, I hope.
Hopefully both you and Senator George. Questions for Paul Warner?
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Stark.
Just so I understand, basically, Mr. Paul, if you look where I drew this line, everything on the top of that line gets the gets their credit and the folks below the line don't. Did I look at that right?
That's correct, Senator. Because the credit itself is based on sales, but it would be a percent of what your tax liability, and your tax liability is based on net income. So if your sales were a certain amount and you were paying the corporate minimum, for example, then you would be unaffected. So it would be a percentage of what your liability would be based on net income.
And Paul, if I remember correctly, when we were working on this, the calculation on the tax form is relatively simple in terms of how you would calculate it for the individual C taxpayer.
Mr. Chair, the only issue that came up as we were going through the calculation, and I'll ask Chris to add something if I've missed something, but the apportioned corporation, you can see them broken out there, they have to report taxable income. They have to report Oregon sales and U.S. sales in order to calculate their Oregon tax base. We use that percentage, obviously, for the sales factor. However, the Oregon-only companies have that box on their returns as well, yet it doesn't really factor into their tax calculation. So, hence, you'll notice that we have, if you look down that bottom line there, we have a fair amount of unknown, actually almost 25% of the tax liability of those Oregon-only companies are unknown. And that just means that they didn't report that, again, because it's not something that's necessary in computing their taxes of their Oregon-only company. Now, of course, under this calculation, then they would be required to do so in order to be eligible for the credit.
Great. Other questions for Paul Warner? Anyone, Mazin, this is your last chance to testify on the Rainy Day Fund. Okay. He's going to wait for the next time. Anyone else like to testify on House Bill 2031? Close the public hearing on 2031. Open a work session on House Bill 2031.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Thank you. I would like to move the dash V8 amendments to House Bill 2031.
Senator Starr has moved the dash V8 amendments to House Bill 2031. Look pretty straightforward, Senator Starr.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. As this conversation has rolled out, unraveled, over the last several days, the subject matter that's in this amendment was one that was discussed. I think it would make House Bill 2031 a much better bill, and the package overall one that would find a significantly larger level of support on the Senate floor if it were adopted into this bill. And it may even take care of the issues that the majority are worried about as far as getting something to the governor in time to sign. What the bill or what the amendment does is it addresses the estate tax issue. A lot of conversations in this building about raising the exemption from $1 million to $2 million, and that's what this amendment does. It's good for Oregon, it's good for small business, it's good for small family farms. I think it's a good public policy, and if it were incorporated in this bill, again, I think that the issues that the majority has as far as timing would easily be rectified, and this would be something that could easily be included in this measure and move quickly through the process in time, even including a concurrence motion and vote on the House floor, and get to the governor's desk by Friday. So, Mr. Chair, I would urge the passage of the B8 amendments to House Bill 2031.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, I have looked at the estate tax question and am open to it, but my understanding is there's a bill still in the House Revenue Committee that deals not only with the estate tax but also with the corporate minimum in one bill, and that they are in fact negotiating over there the proper form of that bill, and hopefully before this session is out we'll certainly be bringing it to us. To deal with one part of that question without dealing with the other part simply digs a deeper revenue hole and so I can't support this amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
My response to that is that the legislature is, who are at least whoever will support the diversion of the corporate kicker, you're basically already taking $90 million from businesses. A lot of folks out there would see that as a tax increase, and to offset that with a $42 million reduction in taxes to family businesses and small business, I think is more than fair.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Monroe.
I shouldn't argue. But not reducing the tax on wealthy multinational corporations by 67% next year is not a tax increase.
Here we go.
And Mr. Chair.
Here we go. This is a carefully.
This is not all multinational out-of-state corporations. We're talking about a lot of small community businesses that have more than $5 million in sales that, we're taking dollars right out of their pocket that they can reinvest. I can talk specifically, but I won't, about a letter I got from a small business that in my district that had been counting on their corporate kicker as part of their business planning. Happens to be a financial institution that would turn around and put that right back into our community and multiply that 12 times to help build small businesses in addition to the one. So I take offense to the fact that all this money is going to out-of-state multinational corporations. That's absolutely not true.
Just most of it.
So this is a obviously sensitive issues in terms of taxes and people's taxes. And I hate to say it one more time, but this is a very carefully crafted,
yes.
Very bipartisan. The Senate, both caucuses were invited to participate, I think, twice. The invitation was extended to participate in these negotiations. I believe it was declined both times. And that is the product that you see before you that obviously made it through the House with a very strong vote and hopefully we'll enjoy the same level of support in the Senate. Other questions or comments on Senator Starr's B8 motion? Barbara.
No.
Yes.
No.
Votes yes.
Votes aye. Oh, votes no. Jeez.
Almost got him. He's supposed to vote yes and then slam the gavel really fast.
Jeez, that would have, I could have made a name for myself there. Senator Monroe.
I would move House Bill 2031B to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Rod Monroe has moved House Bill 2031 as engrossed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on Senator Monroe's motion. Barbara.
Senator Burke.
Aye.
Senator Hewitt?
No.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Senator
Scott? No.
He votes aye.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Starr.
I just wanted to provide notice of a possible minority report on House Bill 2031.
Senator Starr has provided notice of a possible minority report on House Bill 2031.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Starr.
I'd like to provide notice of a possible minority report on House Bill 2707 as well.
Senator Starr has provided notice of a possible minority report on House Bill 2707 as well. We will not meet tomorrow morning at 8:45. We will meet Wednesday. Will be our next meeting. Senator George, I hope you are on the mend, and thank you for coming. Thank you for coming out tonight.
I didn't say a word even when he provoked me.
If I can say one thing, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Paul.
When they brought the bills around today, we got about 30 new bills to the committee. So.
Oh, boy.
We have that to look forward to.
We are adjourned.